You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 53 and Elevator Constructors Local 12. IBEW Local 53 represents construction linemen, electric, gas, and water utility workers, broadcast engineers at TV stations, line clearance workers, linemen for rural electric cooperatives, employees at rural electric generating stations, and anyone else who's interested. And Elevator Constructors Local 12 installs, repairs, modernizes, and maintains elevators, and we thank them for that, and escalators in the western half of Missouri and the entire state of Kansas. The safety of the riding public is always our priority, and we thank our underwriters for their support at the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, suddenly, TIF is back in the news with the hotel and crossroads projects. On tonight's show, we'll find out why citizens are once again mad about TIF. Then, we ask economist Richard Wolff, who thinks worker co-ops are an answer to our dehumanized workplaces, how co-ops work. In the news, Seattle to give Uber and Lyft workers the right to bargain, and what's the Missouri Chamber of Commerce got on its holiday wish list from the legislature? Now for the news.
News from our side, December 17th, 2015. Daniel Beekman of the Seattle Times reports on Monday that Seattle City Council voted unanimously to give taxi, for-hire, and Uber drivers the ability to unionize. The National Labor Relations Act doesn't cover drivers for taxi, for-hire, and app dispatch companies like Uber and Lyft because they are treated as independent contractors rather than employees. Seattle is the first city in the United States to establish a framework for contract drivers to organize and bargain for agreements on issues such as pay and working conditions. Taco Gobina, a 26-year-old Uber driver and leader among those pushing for unionization, called Monday's vote a victory. He was temporarily kicked off the app in August, a few hours after taking part in a news conference with the sponsor of the bill, Mike O'Brien. Uber and Lyft opposes the ordinance and argue that O'Brien's proposal violates federal labor and antitrust laws, meaning the city will likely be sued. Mayor Ed Murray opposed the bill, citing legal and enforcement costs, but O'Brien said this bill was only introduced out of the necessity after witnessing how little power drivers themselves had in working for a living wage. I am proud Seattle is continuing to lead the nation in advancing labor standards for our workers. Under the ordinance, a taxi, for-hire, or app-based vehicle dispatch company will be required to provide the city with a list of its Seattle drivers. Then a nonprofit organization, most likely a union, will use the list to contact the drivers in order to gain the support of a majority of the company's drivers to be designated by the city as their bargaining representative. If they win, the company will be required to bargain with the driver's representative. Likely, there has been much talk nationally about what role governments should play in the country's growing app-powered gig economy. Companies like Uber and Lyft for rides, TaskRabbit for odd jobs, Grubhub for food delivery are attracting workers by offering more flexible more flexibility than conventional jobs. But labor activists and others are worried about apps making it easier for companies to contact independent workers and avoid paying minimum wages and benefits. At the same time, drivers from several cities, including Seattle, were suing Uber for categorizing them as independent contractors, and politicians in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere are talking about whether labor laws need to cover such workers, since at least some of these workers make less than minimum wage. Number two.
The Economic Policy Institute has released a report detailing how many jobs have been lost in the U.S. because of Walmart sourcing from China. Some may recall that at the time China joined the World Trade Organization in 2001, trade negotiators promised a deal would reduce the U.S. trade deficit with China and create good U.S. jobs. However, our trade deficit continued to growing, reaching $324.2 billion in 2013, eliminating 3.2 million U.S. jobs. So, how many of those jobs lost are the fault of Walmart? As the world's largest retailer, they are a key conduit of Chinese imports into the American market. EPI's Robert Scott has provided a conservative estimate of Walmart's Chinese imports, which found that the Walmart-based trade deficit with China alone eliminated or displaced over 400,000 U.S. jobs between 2001 and 2013. Three-fourths of those jobs, or 300,000, were in manufacturing. Walmart has announced plans to create opportunities for American manufacturing by investing in American jobs. To date, very few actual U.S. jobs have been created by this program. And since 2001, the growing Walmart trade deficit with China has displaced more than 100 U.S. jobs for every actual or promised job created through this program.
While Republicans debate the best ways to seal off the U.S. from immigrants from Latin America and the Middle East, their members in Congress are scheming how to import more cheap guest workers. In the proposed 2016 omnibus spending bill, already passed in the House and the Senate, the House version contains provisions that would strip protections and lower wages in the H-2B guest worker program. Workers' rights groups think this change will result in pink slips for U.S. workers and more exploitation for foreign workers who come here on contracts to work in difficult and often dangerous jobs in industries such as landscaping, forestry, seafood processing, hospitality, carnivals, and construction. The conference committee, which has to iron out differences in the House and Senate versions, could strip out the provisions affecting the H-2B visa. If left in, we would admit almost 200,000 additional low-wage guest workers with no protections against being brought in and then idled without work or pay for long periods of time. The proposed language would also prevent U.S. workers from getting first dibs at jobs by preventing enforcement of U.S. worker recruitment rules and denying U.S. workers the rights to the same wages as H-2B workers. Finally, the bill would permit employers to pay unfairly low wages for both migrant and U.S. workers.
The Missouri Times says that for the first time next year, a new business alliance led by the Missouri Chamber of Commerce will work for a joint business-friendly agenda in Jefferson City. Daniel P. Meehan, Missouri Chamber President and CEO, explained that the chamber has been asking local chambers of commerce and their members to look beyond their regional economies and join in working together, and 75 local chambers have coalesced around a set of shared legislative priorities for 2016. Their priorities are a mixed bag. Some positives could be more investment in roads and public education, but a few, if passed, will seriously hurt Missouri's working people. They are fixing Missouri's job-killing legal climate, enacting right-to-work protections for Missouri workers, and reforming Missouri workers' compensation system. You can guess what all that would do for hardworking Missourians, so stay tuned. The news tonight was read by Michael Savoir, Shaikalyn Hams, Ariana Eckel, and I'm Jen Zaman.
There is an uncivil, unjust, covert class war being waged upon us from sea to shining sea. Some of the wealthiest among us, not content with all they've got, want more and more from you and from me. They want to bust up the unions, the middle class and the working class, and drive us all into poverty there.
My name's Lon Swearingen, and our guest tonight is Kevin Masters, who is the Director of Governmental Relations for the Kansas City Public Schools. The discussion will be about the tax increment finance, known as TIF. Kevin, let's get started. Why is TIF so controversial?
Thanks, Lon, for having me. I think from the simple standpoint, it's so controversial because it involves money. In big sums of money, hundreds of millions of dollars. Money and control. And generally, anytime you're having a conversation about large sums of money and who controls it, it creates debate, it creates controversy. And for me, at the root, in the most basic standpoint, it's a controversy because it's a fight over money. That's what it comes down to. It's always a debate, a discussion, and a battle over money.
And now, how do TIF incentives impact the Kansas City Public Schools and the city?
The way it impacts Kansas City Public Schools, and I won't go over a lot of figures because I just don't think we have the time to, but the one figure I will go over is I'll talk about how much money should have gone into public education just over the last 5 to 6 years. Somewhere in the neighborhood of $155 to $170 million that should have gone into public education, not just Kansas City Public, but also the charter schools that are in our catchment areas.
Right.
They should get some of this revenue as well to educate their students. When you start talking about $150 million of real property taxes that should be in public education, that's not going into public education, instead it's going into brick and mortar, building pretty buildings, which are important and which we need those as well. That's how it impacts at least Kansas City Public Schools. It impacts us because whenever an incentive is granted, it freezes our base. In other words, in 2015, if it cost us $100 million or if we receive $100 million worth of real property taxes to fund our programs, whenever there's an incentive for 10 or 15 years, it freezes our base. So 10 years from now, 15 years from now, we'll still have $100 million. Well, guess what? Our insurance goes up, our light bills go up, our electric bills go up, our gas bills go up, cost of living goes up. The same increases you have on a day-to-day basis in your personal lives, well, so does Kansas City Public Schools. So it freezes our base so that we can't fund out-year services the way that we need to fund them. That's how it impacts Kansas City Public Schools.
So, but how about the city? What is supposed to happen with TIF money? I've heard that it's for blighted areas, but what I've seen is it's for places like the Plaza,
yeah,
and what the Crossroads and these kinds of things. So what does that mean?
And that's at the heart of some of the controversy now. What is blight? Blight is defined by stature, and most of the development community as well as the political community will say, hey, we define blight based on what the statutory definition is. And what we try to say is, there's a statutory definition for blight. It's really designed to be, areas that are, that haven't had any investments, areas that without some additional revenue, without something to force development into that area, Prospect, Troost, Hardesty, some of the areas further east of town, that's what the blight statute and that's what TIF and other incentives, I think, in their original iterations were designed to impact. What you will hear from the development community and the political community, people who make decisions on whether they're granted or not, is, hey, there's a statutory definition. We're following the statutory definition. And what frustrates us is the statutory definition only is enabling. It enables you to say, okay, this is blighted. We think a city policy should be a little bit more restrictive in terms of what blight actually is. I mean, if there's a crack in the ceiling, if you've got concrete or asphalt that's eroding, if you got 12 beer cans sitting in your parking lot, if you got, let's say a homeless citizen has walked by and left their camp, based on the statutory definition of blight, you can almost say that's a blighted area. We think, we in the education community, it's not just Kansas City Public Schools, it's actually some of the suburban schools as well. We think the city should really look at this whole definition of blight and be a little bit more restrictive so that it is truly blighted communities.
But it's the commission that does that. How does that work with the council? You've got the TIF commission. What basically do they do?
What the TIF commission's role is, The mayor has six appointees to the TIF Commission, and within Jackson County, Kansas City Public Area, the other taxing jurisdictions consist of Kansas City Public Schools. We have two representatives. Jackson County has two representatives. And then there's a representative that represent multiple entities, the Kansas City Public Library, the Metropolitan Community Colleges, Jackson County Social Services, the disabled, Jackson County Disabilities. So what happens is the mayor has five appointees and the other taxing jurisdictions, or the mayor has six appointees and the other taxing jurisdictions have five appointees. What we should be doing is vetting these different projects that come through to say, you know what, does this really meet blight? Does it really need even a public subsidy at the level in which they're asking for it in order to move forward? And quite frankly, what happens more often than not, the city appointees will generally vote yes, and the rest of us will vote no, and we lose all the time because there's six of them and five of us. There's just the way I describe it is, there's differences in philosophy right now with the education community and with some elements of the political, I won't say all elements within the political system being the city council, but there's a difference between philosophies between the education communities and some of the political elements that are within City Hall.
Now, some of the incentive supporters state that Kansas City Public School doesn't lose anything in an incentive deal because taxes are still paid. How do you react to that?
Well, with a bit of laughter, to be honest with you, Lon, because here's how it works. What they will say is, or what they say is, well, if we're paying $100,000 in taxes, well, guess what? During the period of this incentive, we're going to continue to pay $100,000 in taxes. Therefore, you're not losing anything. You know, we're going to continue to pay $100,000 worth of taxes over a 10, 15, or 25-year period. Well, what we say is, well, wait a minute. If you're going to bill a several million-dollar structure, and it's a commercial structure, and by law, you're generally supposed to pay X amount of taxes, the fact that you're going to be receiving revenues, positive revenues, and you're going to be putting a crap load of money in the bank for your investors and yourself, the fact that, other taxing jurisdictions, the city, the county, they're going to be receiving sales tax, EATs, and a whole bunch of new revenues that they can put in their bank so that they can continue to provide their services, and we're talking new money, to try to flip the script to say, wait a minute, we're going to continue to pay that $100,000 now for the next 25 years. By the way, we're going to pay the county $500,000, and we're going to pay the city maybe $2 million, but you guys should just be happy with your $100,000 because you're not losing anything. What we're losing is our ability to grow and our ability to continue our social services. That's what we're losing.
And then, just curious, Kevin, what do you think about the petition initiative to have the public vote on the TIF for the BNIM project?
And first I need to clear something up because a lot of people are saying, and a lot of people think that Kansas City Public Schools, we started that whole initiative, and we did not. That was a groundswell from taxpayers and parents who, from kids, families in the district. What I think about it is I think it's the democratic process working, the way it's supposed to work. I mean, we live in America. We live in a country where there's supposed to be democratic processes so that people can engage in their government. People can engage in policies. People can engage. There's a city charter that actually allows this particular thing to happen. What I think about the process, I think it's all part of the process. And it's a good thing that we have a democratic process that lets taxpayers make a determination in terms of how their monies are being spent.
Okay. Then do other entities... I've heard that the library loses money because of this also. So public entities that gain their money from property taxes are lose because of this.
We are, I would say, public education. And when I say public education, I include the library in there because,
right.
I mean, it's an educational institution. Public education and social services, real taxpayer-based social services are the big losers. And here's the reason why. whenever you make a decision to freeze a public entity at its base, literally what you do is you don't keep it where it is, you set it backwards.
Right.
To the point, once again, when you freeze the budget of an entity for 15 or 25 years while yours is growing, which some of the other taxing jurisdictions, their base budgets grow, we can't continue to provide services next year and in 2018 for the same cost that we do today. And it's hurting the public library, it's hurting public education as well as other social services.
So how did this happen? The idea that we have this hotel that's going to get money, and now we're going with a building that they've really sold on the concept because it's going to go green and it's going to do this and it's going to do that. But what I'm asking is, how did this all develop that way?
You know, more often than not, it all. I mean, it's a byproduct of. And we like the projects. I mean, many of the projects we like, usually when we look at the financing, that's the part where it gets a little bit murky, and that's when we have the debates and we have the disagreements. You know, I don't know. Maybe a component of it is, you know, it's some of it is relationship based. I'm just going to be honest. I mean, there are always relationship bases where friends want to help friends. Some of it is, you know, in the case of the project, I think that's been the center of so much controversy. You know, it's a great business, and we, like everyone else, we'd like to retain the business here. However, you know, we don't want to use public education dollars to retain them here because we think there are other avenues that can be taken. What happens is, you know, you get the developer and you get the development community, and they're all lawyers. And
right.
They know City Hall, and they know where to go through in City Hall and
right.
The backdoor systems and how to make these things work. They are good at what they do. And, you know, more often than not, the decisions are made long before the school district, the library, the mental health services. The decisions are made long before we're brought to the table. And so we think one of the solutions is making sure, you know, when you're going to the back door of City Hall and when you're going to the back door of the EDC and when you go into all these other places to make these deals, bring us in the conversation so we could talk about our concerns early on. So that way later down the line, we don't have what we have now.
Is there a way that for areas such as what they're going to do with the urban initiative, is there any way that can be utilized and those people come in and get something going from this angle instead of just giving it to the other areas? Is there a way to do that?
Yeah, there's a way to do that. I mean, EDC, there are good processes. There are good statutory entities that have systems in place that, you know, if you want to actually do economic development, if you want to do brick and mortar construction, there is an avenue to do it. And there's a good system and a good avenue to do it. The problem right now is while the system's there, the system's in place, the priority in terms of where these investments, that's what's off kilter right now. The city's got a good process. The EDCs, they have a good process. What needs to occur now is a very public philosophical change that, okay, we've invested enough in downtown, at least if you need a public subsidy. We've invested enough in the plaza and crossroads and some of these other areas, even the River Market to some degree. What needs to happen now is a very public statement from the mayor as well as others within the political system who really believe, and I think they do believe, we need to push economic development, brick and mortar projects further east. They just need to tell the development community, hey, you can build all you want on a plaza. You can build all you want in downtown, but we're not going to give you a subsidy. If you build over here, then let's talk about a subsidy. And I think the development community will probably move east. They just haven't been told to yet.
And so how do we do that? What would be your suggestion to help develop that concept?
You know, and I think a part of it is in process. A part of it's in play based on kind of what's unfolding right now. There's already, because I've heard it, in City Hall where they're talking about, you know what, we need to look at the areas we want to have the subsidies or the incentives. I think the discussion is being had probably at the lower levels. What I would suggest is the taxpayers, the people who actually write the checks and send them to Jackson County Assessor's Office, is that, you know, they hold their elected officials accountable. You know, just like they hold us accountable for public education and they hold the library and all those other social services accountable, I think we're at a point where we need to make sure we're holding the people who make the decisions on approving and are not approving the incentives accountable to say, hey, we need you to say if it's not in these areas, and it's not for us, at least Kansas City Public, to identify what these right. areas are. You know, it's for the taxpayers and for a broader community to determine that.
So how much will the school district lose if these two projects go into effect, approximately?
Okay. The one project I think that you're referring to is probably the 17th Street Amendment, which is the Helzberg Development BNIM. I think they're looking for about a $5.3 million incentive, somewhere in the neighborhood of $2.3 million would be public education dollars.
So all of this, again, goes from property tax?
Yes.
So in 15 years or whatever the amount, how many years do they get this?
They're looking at, on a TIF, it's generally, by law, it's 23 years.
23 years.
So that's
years.
The maximum, well, that's
and,
the maximum
and
they
then
should have.
You basically start paying the taxes that you're supposed to.
That's the theory, you know, and our concern and our issue with that is, you know, that don't always happen. An example is, you know, and they were a great tenant when they were here. Let's say AMC, you know, they were down in their headquarters. There was a TIF in order to keep them here and get them here. Well, guess what? At the end of their 25-year TIF, what did they do? They went over to Kansas. And so, you know, what people will say is, well, wait a minute. In 20-something years or in whatever period, you guys are going to get a lot of money. What we're finding is many of those businesses actually leave at the end,
right.
and then we're stuck with a vacant building that a new developer will come in and say, hey, this is an old building.
So if
I need an abatement. I need more money. So we end up spending more money. It's like spending good money after bad money.
Now, the idea is, and this is the thing that I find to be true, you're basically begging people to be here. If you give them that kind of incentive,
right?
I mean, and then they can leave,
right?
And after 23 years, you can figure out, well, we can go somewhere else,
right?
Yeah. And they'll do the same thing there, won't they?
And that my guess is that probably that we may get AMC back. We'll get them back probably in, you know, whatever that abatement period is over in Kansas. My guess is they may come back to the Missouri side because we'll offer them a sweet deal and. They can just keep going back and forth. Here, the one figure I do want to talk about, because we're kind of talking about it.
We got about.
Yeah, we're good. It's going to take me about, you know, in 2010, if you look at all the assessed values in Jackson County, and this is just public education in Jackson County, our base budget was about $107 million. 2005, I'm sorry. 2015, it was about $106 million. So between 2005 and 2015, you look at all the development that's done that was supposed to increase the assessed value that goes into tax collections, we've actually decreased our collections by $1 million since 2005. So all the economic development incentives didn't help us.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate you being here, Kevin. And you've given me a lot of things to think about because it would be something that we need to do.
Thank you for having us.
I sold you mortgages,
ooby-doo.
I knew they were surprised,
ooby-doo.
Hey, but they made me rich,
ooby-doo.
It was a thrilling time,
ooby-doo.
I kept you borrowing,
ooby-doo.
Now you've lost everything,
ooby-doo.
And you still owe me. Treasury, said I'd adjust your loan. I'd do it leisurely. I kept my bonuses. One little bonus is that you still owe me.
And that was Pat Wynn with The Banker's Song on her new CD. I'm Judy Hansel. Richard Wolff is a retired economics professor who is hardly retired. Since he's traveling around the country speaking, he does a radio program called Monthly Economic Update, which you hear sometimes on KKFI. And he does many, many speaking engagements. And he was here in September, and he spoke at All Souls Unitarian Church and at UMKC about his new passion, which is worker-owned co-ops. The recording then was done, of this interview, was done in September in a hotel restaurant, so please excuse some of the outside noise. Thank you for being willing to be interviewed.
Oh, my pleasure.
We've had lots of economists on this show who critique the economic system of capitalism. Some call for reform, some want more reform, and some just want to send all the bankers to jail. But few want to change the whole system or advocate for socialism. So I don't want to go through the sad history of how our economy and government tanked. What I want to do is talk about an alternative with you. So let me ask you first, just briefly, you say capitalism isn't delivering the goods, it's delivering the bads, and that it's facing major repeated crises. Can you do in a nutshell why that is and why we have to look at alternatives?
Well, there's several reasons. Basically, if I thought that reform, a little of it or a lot of it or some medium amount of it, or throwing bankers in jail, if that would solve the problem, I'd be the first one to line up and salute that course of action. But we've been there and we've done that. That doesn't work. That's why we're in the soup that we're in now. We imposed rules and regulations after the last collapse of capitalism in the 1930s. It was supposed to prevent us from being in the position we are now. So something more has to be done. I also don't think throwing bankers in the jail is much of a solution, because the bankers who replace them when they are carted off to jail will be stuck in the same system with the same pattern of rewards and punishments and incentives, and they're going to be able to do the same thing, and even if they get caught, they'll be replaced by people who do that. When everybody who plays by the rules of the system produces a mess, then it's time not to punish them, but to change the system.
Okay, thanks. Your project is variously called Democracy at Work and Worker Self-Directed Enterprises, or WSDEs. So let's just take a hypothetical. Say you work for Harley Davidson making motorcycles here in Kansas City. If we could wave a wand and turn it into a WSDE, what would it look like? How would it be different from today? Now, remember that Harley has a union, and in fact it has two unions, and Harley had some kind of self-directed work team kind of stuff in the 90s, which is still sort of there. So tell us what a WSDE Harley might look like.
Okay. The key thing is this word directed or self-directed. The idea is that the workers at Harley Davidson or at any store or office or factory would become their own bosses. It's kind of the American dream of a person. Many of my younger students, when you ask them what they want in their lives, they say, I want to be my own boss. Well, the time has arrived. We have to become our own bosses because the existing system of bosses isn't doing the job. So here's how it would look. Monday to Thursday, just hypothetically, you'd come and you'd do pretty much what you do now. You'd have your specialized tasks, you'd have the skill that you bring to whatever it is that you do. But then on Friday, or if it's not every Friday, maybe every other Friday, you come to work, but that day you do not make Harleys. What you do is you sit around with your fellow workers and you discuss the basic decisions of your enterprise. What you're going to produce, what technology you're going to use, where you're going to do all of this, and what you're going to do with the profits that you all helped to produce. You become your own boss. You become your own board of directors. It becomes a collective, democratically operated enterprise. And you have then your own fate in your own hands. And think about it with me just for a moment. if the question comes up of closing the plant and moving to Shanghai, you're not going to vote that way. The people in that room are not going to do that. They're going to put the well-being of their families, of their neighborhoods, of the city of Kansas City that needs the revenue that comes from that plant. They're going to put that ahead of a marginal improvement in their profits. And so the whole structure and history of the American economy is going to be very different if we finally do it. And I haven't even got to the best part. If you're a Democrat with a small d, if you believe in democracy, then you will have noticed, I hope, that when you go to work in the morning, you enter a place where there isn't any, where a tiny group of people who own and operate the business make all the decisions, and you just have to live with them. That's not what democracy is.
No, it's a dictatorship.
It's a dictatorship, and long ago we should have brought democracy to the place where most adults spend most of their lives, at work. And what I'm suggesting is we have a window now where it's recognized that the old system isn't delivering the goods that we need and want and have every right to as citizens. And so it's time to move on and change this system and reorganize the way we do produce goods and services, because it's a better way of organizing economics than what we now have.
There's so many questions I could ask you about, you know, can you do this on a big scale? Like, what do you do with Ford Motor Company or even Harley? But I'm not going to go there because I want to focus more on how you get there. You know, co-ops in this country haven't done so well. We've had a long history since before the Civil War. People have been experimenting.
Even before the Revolutionary War we've had.
Okay. So most of them have failed. And so why do you think that they could succeed now? I mean, they have trouble competing with capitalist enterprises because they're cutthroat and they do loss leaders and they don't play fair.
Let me respond. It's a question I'm asked often. First of all, it may be surprising to learn, but the majority of capitalist enterprises also fail. That is... That is, they try, they do their best, and they don't make it in the market, and then they're swallowed up by the companies that do a better job for whatever reason, et cetera, et cetera. And so, yes, some co-ops fail, and I'm not aware of any form of enterprise that doesn't have that kind of vulnerability. But let me, rather than speculate on how it might work, let me give you the example of the most successful co-op in the world right now, because it tells... in a way, to answer this question. It's called the Mondragon Corporation.
We did a radio show about it a year ago because I went there.
Okay, I went there too, but very quickly. This starts in 1956 in the mountains of northern Spain. A Catholic priest named Father Arizmendi, in a very, very poor part of this country, takes six workers and starts a co-op. He basically makes a joke. If we wait until the capitalists come here to provide work, we'll all die of old age before it happens. And so let's make a co-op. Okay, fast forward to today. The Mondragon Corporation has roughly 100,000 employees. It's the seventh largest corporation in Spain. I tell you the story because it's a story of unparalleled success. A company that gets larger and larger, that would, this record of going from six people in half a century to 100,000 is a record any capitalist enterprise in the world would envy for its success. Along the way, by the way, there are now a group of about 250 to 300 co-ops that are in this corporation. They've had to compete with all manner of capitalist enterprises in the marketplace, and they have succeeded. Many of those capitalist firms went out of business because they couldn't compete with the co-op. One of the reasons co-ops will work and can work and have worked is that the simple and very American idea, if the workers are also the owners and directors of the enterprise, they give more of themselves to it. They're more alert to find a new efficiency. They're more concerned that it be successful. Their whole lives and fortunes are wrapped up in it in a way that a person who can move from one job to another working always for somebody else will never feel. And that translates into efficiencies and benefits that can be harnessed to make these very successful.
I went to Mondragon a year ago and interviewed their public affairs guy, Michael, something, and did a radio show about it. It's fascinating, and I was really impressed. But one of the things he told me was that they had recently closed down a whole division, which made appliances, because they made a decision that they could not compete with China, and they could not keep their standards. And so the question arises, I think, when you spoke, you you talked about, you know, the workers keeping their company from offshoring, you know, keep the jobs here. So how do we deal in a global economy where you have corporations and enterprises that are, you know, like paying the lowest wages and making shoddy equipment, and there's no rules to prevent that? Do we shut the borders and not import? Do you have you thought that through?
Sure. There's a number of things that an alert and organized workforce committed to co-ops could do. It's not that it's this one is better than that one. It's a whole collection of things. So let me go through just a couple of them. The first is, if you actually run a business, you know that there's always 1,000 things that need to get done to make the business work better. Find a cheaper source of raw materials, get a better class of workers, get a new kind of machine, move over here, try this other product. It's endless, and businesses, the leaders of business always are going crazy trying to know and implement all of the available things. If you are discovering that there's another producer in the world, whether it's China or India or Brazil or anything else, that systematically manages to outproduce you, to do something of good or equal or better quality at a lower price, that will be a signal to you at a certain point that you stop looking for your own way to match what they do, and that there often are such. But at a certain point, you might decide, I can't do that. And at that point, you produce something else. You change the commodity you produce, and you move to something else, maybe something similar but a little bit different, where you have, guess what, an advantage, which is, after all, what they did in China when they did what they did that creates the competition for us, number one. Number two, I think if you had worker co-ops, you'd see a much more sustained effort by the United States government, in cooperation with others, to insist in a powerful way that workers in other countries be accorded the kinds of working conditions and wages and supports that the American workers struggled for a long time to get them. The solution to the problem is to create conditions. Let me take a stark example, but one that's important. If we had worked for the last 50 years to give decent working conditions to the people of Central America, then there wouldn't be millions of those folks coming here. Before we have big struggles in our country about whether to accept and how to accept and what decency requires, let's understand the underlying reality. People don't get up, leave the places in which they were born, where their families are, where their communities are, where their ties are, where their language is familiar, and go to a place where they don't know whether they'll be welcomed or not, where they can't hardly take anything with them. That's a traumatic event. You don't do that unless the place in which you live has become unlivable. We should never have been as unfeeling towards our fellow Western Hemisphere folks as we have been. Had we been more attentive to the conditions of work and life, then we would not have had the very problems we now find so intractable. And I think that applies to workers too. If we provided the kinds of conditions that we want for ourselves and insisted on them elsewhere, then we wouldn't face the kind of competition that scares us now.
Yeah, I think that's right. Mondragon, though, has no unions. Do you envision a role for unions in an American version of this, or would they become obsolete because the workers run the company?
Well, I think what we need to ask is the question, the union arose because in a capitalist enterprise there's endless conflict between the owners and operators at the top and everybody else. Those who live off profit want it to be the largest, and those who live off wages want them to be the largest. And that means we organize our production system with a fundamental conflict at the core of how we organize things. That's neither smart nor very efficient. That creates tension and conflict. If the work,
incredible waste of time.
And an incredible waste of everybody's efforts. That's right. It's, you know, I like to use the little example. If everybody in your family gets along except Uncle Harry and Aunt Clara, if you're organizing the family picnic for this year, would you put Aunt Clara and Uncle Harry together to organize it? The answer is no, because they don't get along, and everybody should understand that. Why we put into our production system an arrangement in which people are at each other's throats all the time and then wonder that it end results aren't so good, I find mystifying.
That sounds like an argument for no unions in capitalism.
Well, you know, it has always been the dream of the employer that there are no unions in capitalism, and it's always been the dream of the workers, even if they keep it a secret, that they really wish there were no bosses and they could take care of it themselves. And that's part of the struggle that never stops. I think in a workers' co-op, you get over that because the workers are now on both sides of that fence. It's really become internalized. They are part-time the workers and part-time the bosses, fulfilling the dream of workers to be their own bosses. And I think then it'll be an open question what kind of role for a union might be remaining. You might want certain things to be an association of people who are doing one kind of thing in that factory or in that office, and they could form what they could call a union or whatever other name they feel. I don't want to prejudge how that goes. Organizations like unions are formed when people need them, when people's lives depend on it, when they're willing to commit the time and energy to build and sustain those kinds of organizations. In capitalism, I think they're important and necessary. And if they prove to be that in an economy organized by co-ops, that's fine with me. And by the way, here in the United States, some of the leadership in moving towards co-ops is actually being taken by the United Steelworkers of America, which is a union with a long history in the United States. They see it together. Last point. Here's a way of understanding how they could work together. The biggest source of problem for American workers in the last 30 years has been a company that calls the workers together bright one Monday morning and says, we're thinking of moving to China to close this factory, close this store, close this office, and relocate in Brazil or wherever they're going. At which point, the union perks up and gets terrified because they're basically being told their jobs are going to disappear. And then the employer makes the key point. Of course, I could stay here if you give me concessions, if you accept lower wages, fewer benefits, all of that. And then the union, usually, sad to say, but it is the truth, tries as best it can to minimize the amount of concessions they make to the employer, and that's the end result. Now, with me, enjoy the following scenario. The union listens to the employer make the threat of leaving and all that, and says to the surprised employer, oh, you're leaving? Have a nice trip. Good luck to you. But let me tell you what's going to happen when you leave. We're going to take over this business. We, the workers who work here, we will stay here. We'll stay here with the machines, and we'll stay here with the raw materials and with the markets, and we're going to produce it. And we're going to run around America and tell everybody you've got a choice. You can buy what you've been buying from this company, but it's now in China or Brazil or someplace else. It's a company that abandoned America, abandoned its employees, plunged the community into a crisis, or you can buy from us, the people who stayed here, who are your fellow citizens, and you can help sustain the city, the town, the community where all of this is taking place. When the employer hears what it is he faces if he leaves, he's going to think long and hard about leaving. It's a strategy which wins either way. You either persuade the employer not to leave without giving concessions, or he leaves and you have an alternative that's a lot better than a long, what we call, race to the bottom, as employers keep threatening and unions keep caving, and we have what we have seen in 40 years.
Okay, but so how do the workers get their hands on the equipment and the property? Are you talking about changing laws, or are you talking about breaking laws?
Well, that's a very good question. My hope is we can change the laws. And sometimes the best way to change the law is to break it a little bit. I believe it's called civil disobedience, but that's not what I'm calling for at all. It turns out there are all kinds of laws already on the books here in the United States that permit workers to take over enterprise. I'm just going to give you two. One is called ESOPs, Employee Stock Ownership Programs.
Not tax dodge.
Yeah, it's basically a tax maneuver, that's right, in which workers have advantages they can give to an employer by buying him out. And they can get the financing for this and their legal arrangements to make it possible. So, and by the way, it's happened. It's happened to thousands of firms across the United States.
There's a grocery store chain in this area called Hy-Vee, which says the workers own it, and it's one of those. But right. Of course, the workers don't manage it.
Right. Management is always different from the ownership. My only point is for workers to take over an enterprise. That's not a mystery. That's not a pie-in-the-sky utopian dream. That's something that goes on all over the place and can be done. But let me get at it in a different way. It is also possible for workers to use local political authorities to help them. And let me be real blunt about how this works. You go to your local, I've done this, so I'm speaking from experience. You go to your local mayor or senator or governor or whoever it is, and you say to him, such and such a company is planning to close and is threatening us. We're going to take it over. We're going to run it if they leave. And we want your help, dear governor, dear mayor, whoever. And here's how you can help us. You have something called the right of eminent domain. You can take property at a reasonable market price, and we want you to take this factory and the machines in it and everything to preserve this community, the jobs in it, the revenue that you as governor or senator or get from this. All of this is perfectly legal and done all the time. And here comes the political punch. We say to dear Mr. Governor, if you do this, what we want you to do, we will be your biggest boosters, your biggest cheerleaders. We will run around your district telling everybody, your voters, that you saved these jobs, you saved these lives, you saved the community the revenue it needs to do the things you want.
You're not a socialist, right?
And you're not a socialist. You're a good entrepreneurial innovator.
Yeah.
But the flip side of that, which doesn't have to be said because every politician understands it, if you don't do what we're asking you, you will be the person we tell everybody lost the opportunity, lost the jobs, damaged the revenue of the community you're supposed to serve. You win big if you do what we ask you. You lose big if you don't. It's blunt, it's clear, and since every politician knows how this is done, in fact, this kind of conversion from an existing capitalist to a collective workers' co-op is a political as well as financially feasible thing for us to do now and solves problems we are not solving any other way.
Well, Rick Wolf, I think we're out of time, but I want to... thank you for this, and I want you to finish up with this wonderful story you told when you talked about the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs.
It was a few years ago, and I went down to just north of San Jose, California, known as Silicon Valley because so many big computer, high-tech companies locate there. And I was invited to give a talk. And the people in the audience were youngish engineers who had walked away from high-paying jobs as software engineers, by and large, because they wanted a different way of working together. And so all of them had taken their laptops and gathered in the garage behind the home of one of them where there was space and set up a new little business, living out their dream. In this business, they would come to work in their Bermuda shorts and their Hawaiian shirts with their toddlers and their Frisbees in tow. They would work 4 days a week on their software. The fifth day of the week, they would sit around, make the basic decisions. Everybody was equal. All decisions of the business were arrived at through consensus or democratic voting, if it had to come to that. And they loved it, and they described it to me with glowing eyes. They felt better about going to work each morning than they had ever done before. They didn't have some stuffed shirt with a tie and a jacket telling them what to do. They made the decisions, and they insisted that they were much more productive and much more inventive as new technology leaders in this way. I leaned across the table when they were done, and I said to them, this may come as a shock. I had no idea how big a shock it would be, but it might come as a shock to you to know that what you've done is literally walked away from capitalism and organized a collective communal system, which is what Marx had in mind when he used the word communism. You guys, there were very few women in this group, you guys have voted with your feet against one system that you quit and another one that you organized. And these fellows looked at me. You should have seen their faces. I wished I only had had a camera to catch it. Gasping, and I mean gasping, they said to me, we're all Republicans. And I smiled and I said, sure. And that's because you've never grown up in a society that explained to you the alternative ways of organizing business. You've had to figure it out on your own, using your own language and your own thinking. But you've ended up in a very similar place, and it might be worth thinking what that might mean.
Thank you. Where can people find more information about this topic?
Everything that I do with the team that I work with is available 24/7, no charge whatsoever, on two websites. Please make use of them. We update them and add to them every day. The first one is called Democracy at Work. That's all one word, democracyatwork.info. And the second website is my name, rdwolf, with two Fs, .com, rdwolf.com, democracyatwork.info. Make use of them. There's more material there than you will have time to review, and it's all there for your use.
And we'll put those links on our website. Thank you very much, Richard Wolf.
Thank you, Judy. Much obliged.
Heartland Labor Forum Calendar, December 17, 2015. Monthly Worker Rights Intake Clinic for Victims of Wage Theft, Monday, December 21st from 5 to 8 p.m. Free Lunch Gala and Entertainment Event for the Community, Friday, December 25th from 1 to 3 p.m. Empower Missouri's First Friday Forum of 2016 will be held on the second Friday with Jeanette Mott Oxford, Executive Director, on Friday, January 8th from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Check out the Heartland Labor Forum schedule on the web at www.heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also listen to today's show. Tune in next week to Heartland Labor Forum. Our show will be called Our Holiday Wish, No War But the Class War. Thanks to our engineer, Jen Zaman. I'm Ariana Eckel. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.